Each little crunchy contains energy, contains pep for your growing youngsters, builds strong legs so that when they're older, they can stand the long waits in the unemployment lines.
When you're slapped, you'll take it and like it.
So this thing had the claws of a lion and the fangs of a snake?
It reminds me of a woman I once knew in Cleveland.
Attention, you are now entering the debarkation area. No talking, no smoking. Follow the orange line to the processing area. The next scheduled departure to the prison is in 2 hours. You now have the option to terminate and be cremated on the premises. If you elect this option, notify the duty sergeant in your processing area.
You always have a very smooth explanation ready, huh?
What do you want me to do, learn to stutter?
Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 31. My name is Terry Frost, and this is the Child Safe Movie Podcast this time around. Hi, how are you guys? We're doing well here. It's turned into winter here in Melbourne, and everything's gone cold and dark and damp, and in general, not what we would want it to be. Yeah, this time around, we're going to do movies that are safe for children. I got an email from a friend called Danny Oz. And he recommended that I do a podcast of movies that kids should watch. So I let it brew for a little while. I kind of cogitated. I mulled it around. I let it ferment in a bucket full of dog urine for a while. And came up with what this podcast, basically. So this time around, what I'm going to be doing is looking at movies that are suitable for children. Not necessarily children's films, but movies that encourage in children a love of cinema. Nothing, you know, I'm not going to recommend the Saw franchise or Psycho or any Russ Meyer film, but there are a wide range of movies from the paleo cinema end of things that would be really good fun to introduce children to so that they get an education in the basics of movies, broaden them out beyond watching whatever Pixar and DreamWorks put out and whatever the latest big blockbuster franchise is. So I've been asked to do this, and I thought it was a good idea. So I kind of did my research, asked a lot of people at work, what kind of movies did you watch as a kid? What kind of stuff influenced you? What kind of stuff did you enjoy? Got a lot of answers I didn't want, but I did get some useful stuff. So thanks to everybody I hassled about this particular one. I'll just let Sal do her intro. We'll do a little bit of correspondence. There's a little bit, not too much at the moment, but we'll do that, and then we'll get stuck into child-safe movies.
Paleo Cinema is a three-weekly podcast that looks at film noir, horror, cult movies, classic films, science fiction, and other genre works from 1895 to 1980. The email address is cultguru@gmail.com, cultguru@gmail.com. So please send comments, feedback and MP3 voicemails to that address. The blog for the podcast, which has lots of extra content relating to each episode and a chat window where you can interact with other listeners, is paleo-cinema.blogspot.com.
Okay, I've got to thank Sal for her help on that one. If I don't say thank you for her support and help each and every podcast, she listens to it and then gives me a lot of shit about not saying thank you to her for her patience and support on all the podcasts. So thank you for your patience and your support in the podcast, Sal. Okay, moving right along. Got a bit of correspondence. A lot of people are messaging on Twitter, having a chat to them about various things. David Munn's very big on Twitter, so he's worth friending up on there, and if you want to have a little bit of a 140 character dialogue with David or any of the other people on Twitter, it's quite useful. You have to think about what you're going to say when you've got 140 characters in which to say it. But I really do like Twitter. I like the brevity of it. I like the interactivity of it, and it's also good to touch base with just what's going on and what people are enjoying. So it's not the same as a blog or a podcast, but I do see it as just another aspect of this enormous conversation we're all having on the internet in the 21st century. if you've been reluctant to jump on the bandwagon, why the hell not? You don't have to do it for long if you don't enjoy it. But start it up, friend me up if you want to, drop me a little message, and we'll all talk movies. It's probably the best means I've got at the moment of doing that. Some of the other fora I've set up, I set up one on Facebook, and I've also set up one on the website for the podcast. They don't seem to work quite as well as some of the others, but I think Twitter may be the portal of choice for having a chat to people, and you can chat to a lot of other podcasters there. I definitely know that PC Vin, Vince Rotolo from the B-Movie podcast, is very active on Twitter, and as are a number of other podcasters, so just friend up a few people, ask them what they're listening to as far as other podcasts are concerned, and enjoy the whole fun aspect of it. I've got a little bit of advantage with Twitter. I can Twitter quite effectively on my little hip-top slide phone, so I do a bit of that when I think of it. I think the portal of choice for interactive stuff for Paleo Cinema is probably going to be Twitter at this stage. Anyway, on to the messages. Apart from the twittering, I did get a really nice message from our old friend Monty in Detroit. I won't go into all of it. He did try to encourage me to watch Lost as a series. I probably will at some stage, Monty, but I might wait until I can rent the seasons of Lost all in one go and then just kind of sit through them and watch them all. I think the complexity of it lends itself to that kind of approach better than just grabbing little bits at a time. So at some stage I may watch Lost and I'll let you know what I think of it. At the moment I'm enjoying Fringe. Did see the end of the first season of Fringe, which ends with a terrific, wonderful pullback scene. Very much of a headfuck kind of scene. And I recommend, if you get a chance, watch the first season of Fringe. Quite interesting science fiction stuff. And what else to do? Saw the Star Trek movie. Yeah, we enjoyed it. Sal and I went and saw it on Mother's Day at noon. So the cinema was always almost empty. Yeah, I like it as a reboot to the franchise. I would like to see some original movies, though. I think the big blockbuster movies overwhelmingly tend to be franchises or something based on something that's pre-existing rather than a new original work, and I think that's a little bit sad. I really would like to see some large-scale films that have a little more originality to them. But having said that, we enjoyed it. And look forward to the next one of those. So apart from that, Monty said, and I'm going to have to try to shucks this one because he does get quite complimentary on this, and reading it out myself, I get a tiny bit embarrassed by doing that. But anyway, he says, "You are a fascinating social commentator, Terry. This is perhaps one of the main reasons why I tune into the show. You remind me a lot of the late great film reviewer and social commentator Pauline Kael. I'm very grateful for the podcast and, as always, very much interested in your opinions that go beyond the reviews. Take care of yourself. Please say hello to Sal for us. We always welcome her presence on the show." Thanks for the credit there, Monty. I'm not sure that I'm anywhere in the league of Pauline Kael, who is probably one of my favourite movie journalist commentator type people. I do accept the compliment. I suppose it may give me something to work towards with the podcast, getting that kind of mix of talking about the movies, talking about the society around the movies, and finding an entertaining way to do both of those things. I'll look upon that compliment as something to encourage me, and I'd very much appreciate it, so thank you. But, Sal, I keep telling Sal she's got to come back onto the podcast, but she keeps getting grumpy because I told her that I was doing the children's podcast and that I thought that Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz was a whiny little bitch. And she kind of decided she wasn't going to talk about Wizard of Oz on this podcast. Sometimes my opinions get in the way of that sort of thing, but that's it. I did re-watch parts of Wizard of Oz recently. I'm not going to talk about it much in this one, this children's child safe podcast, but I didn't enjoy it. I really can't get past the fact that Judy Garland was a whiny little brat, basically, and let everybody else do everything for her. I realised that it was a movie of its time and that young female characters weren't necessarily as assertive as they would be in a 21st century film. But I found that dissonance something I couldn't overcome in Wizard of Oz. I didn't see it when I was a kid. Maybe that was a problem. I didn't see it at the right age. It wasn't easily available in the cinemas when I was a kid and didn't much turn up on TV either. But on with the motley, and I'll start talking about children's movies, the child-safe movies I'm going to talk about. So I decided to lay out some criteria for myself so that I didn't wander too far off the path. So what did I use? Imaginative films. I think the minds of children need playtime. All day they're learning to count, to read, to obey authority figures, to tie their shoelaces, to not hit each other, and to ask permission to go to the toilet. Kids need some rest and recreation that isn't full of pompous and abstract moral lessons and turgid religious propaganda. So I wanted to make sure that the movies I talked about here and recommended were films that, yes, they're educational in the sense of educating about cinema, but they're not educational, if you know what I mean. I also wanted to make sure they were accessible. The movies need to be able to be found so that people can sit their kids down in front of them and let them watch them. And another criterion was, even though children sometimes have really shit judgment in movies, it doesn't mean that we can't throw quality films their way. I think exposure to good films early means that you don't end up with offspring who think that Shia LaBeouf in Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull is as good as Marlon Brando was in The Wild One. You give them some kind of yardstick to evaluate movies by encouraging them to watch good films. I'll give you an example of what I mean, and it's not about movies, it's about art. Sometime in the early 1970s, the Yellow House Artists Collective owned a multi-story house, sort of like a New York brownstone in King's Cross in Sydney. And they turned the whole building into a work of art. Every part of the house was a work of art. The floors, the ceilings, the walls, the furniture, the whole place was a collaborative work of pop art. Now, I went on a school excursion as a very young teenager at somewhere else in town. I think it may have been an art gallery or a museum or something. And then the teachers snuck us up to King's Cross on the bus and took us into the Yellow House. I think it may have been the Australian Museum in College Street in Sydney we went to. And then afterwards we went up to the Yellow House for a couple of hours. We were sworn to secrecy because some of the art involved female nudity, and the teachers and artists wanted to encourage the kids to be interested in art, and they just let us explore this whole house while the artists themselves talked to us about it. Now, I learned a lot of things from that, and it's one of my fondest memories of a school excursion. I learned that you can live inside art, and that it can be puckish and fun and confronting, and not just something that you look at on a wall when someone shows it to you. It's something you can walk through and experience. At some level, that expanded my conceptual horizons. And I just wish I could remember the teachers who took me there, because they've enriched my life in a small but very important way. Maybe we can do that with movies too. Without showing them things they can't understand, we can get kids to get that first inkling of a love of cinema and teach them that new is not necessarily good, and big and brash isn't always the only way to enjoy movies. And yeah, just give them that kind of grounding in things. So that's kind of where I'm coming from on this. And I wanted to do a checklist, but not in the same way I did with the science fiction checklist a number of podcasts ago. I'll try to narrow it down a little bit, talk in a bit more detail about the movies, and kind of go from there. Some of the movies I've already talked about in the podcast, so I won't linger long on them, but I will kind of put them on there. So grab a pen and paper if you're interested, and we'll go through a few of the films that I think kids should be encouraged to see. Some of them are children's films, but also there are some leaps of faith where I'm going to movies that are actually for adults, but I think kids will like. First off, you can't get past the 1940 Alexander Korda Thief of Baghdad. This is probably the best antidote you have for Disney's Aladdin, which pinched a lot of the plot lines and tropes from Thief of Baghdad. It's one of the great movies. It's full of great movie moments too. We've got Abu the Little Thief, played by Sabu, finding the bottle on the beach and releasing the genie, played by Rex Ingram. You've got Abu's battle with the giant spider as he tries to get the all-seeing eye from the Temple of the Winds at the top of the world. You've got the magnificent evilness of Conrad Veidt's Jafar with his piercing blue eyes and his strange vocal cadences. And you have the prince, played by John Justin, who becomes a blind beggar but shows great strength of character and doesn't let the evil done to him wear him down, but he uses it as a lesson in life. I mean, this is one of the great adventure films. It was made under extraordinary pressures during World War II, which necessitated moving the production from England to Hollywood halfway through. It's got a lot of good things, and it's got adventure, romance, and a message that persisting in the face of adversity is the way to succeed. It doesn't smack you in the face with that, but it's in there for finding, and I think it's a real treasure of movie making, and I think anybody who has a kid should at some stage get them to watch this film. Next one, I'm going to do a bit of a leap about 13 years forward. And I'll just play a little bit of a musical sting from it and give you an idea what it is.
Come on and dress me, dress me, dress me in my finest array. 'Cause just in case you haven't heard, today's Dormido Day. Dress me in my silver garters, dress me in my diamond studs, 'cause I'm going do-me-doing in my do-me-do duds. I want my undulating undies with the marabou frills. I want my beautiful bolero with the porcupine quills. I want my purple nylon girdle with the orange blossom buds, 'cause I'm going do-me-doing in my do-me-do duds.
Okay, in case you didn't pick it up from that clue, it's The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T from 1953, and the guy you heard singing about his undulating undies was Hans Conried. Okay, so you can't do a list like this without name-checking Dr. Seuss. Theodore Geisel knew how to get into the minds of children and bring a wondrous silliness with him. He wrote the original screen treatment and all of the song lyrics for this film too, which is never a bad start. Unfortunately, he didn't like the film. He thought it was, and this is a quote, a debaculous fiasco, and it never got a mention in his official biography. And the movie flopped big time on its original release, and it's only when kids watched it on TV in the 50s and 60s that it got a cult audience. I'll give you a bit of a synopsis in case you don't know the film. A kid called Bart, played by Tommy Reddick, who later became a software engineer in the early days of Silicon Valley, hates his piano practice. He'd rather be out playing with his friends, playing baseball, that kind of thing. His sadistic piano teacher, Dr. Terwilliger, played by Hans Conried, is his major nemesis in life. His mother is a widow, played by Mary Healy, and his father died during World War II, and he thinks that his friend, Mr. Zabludowski the plumber, played by Peter Lind Hayes, should be his new father. While practicing piano, Bart, obviously a name-check precursor to Bart Simpson, dreams of a nightmarish world where Dr. Terwilliger is the fascist dictator of the Terwilliger Institute and plots a maniacal plan to get 500 children to play his giant piano. So, apart from the music, there are a few cool things about this film. The set design and vivid primary colour palette bring a Dr. Seuss world to life. I really like it. It's not a widescreen film, but the Technicolor is used very well in it, and it kind of brings Dr. Seuss to life a lot better than, say, the recent Mike Myers Cat in the Hat debacle. The choreography is a bit rudimentary, and not all the songs work, but there are a couple of cute ones, and there is a really nice touch in this film that the two most vivid characters are Bart himself and Terwilliger. And I really like the fact that this movie has a constant focus on the worldview of a small boy, and they do that in a way that's never forced and is always a bit of a reminder of our own childhoods, where we saw the world a particular way and we had enormous enemies even though they weren't really our enemies. The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T is well worth seeing. It's easily available on DVD. I believe it does show up in America on various cable channels at various times, so definitely one to add to the list. I'm not sure how it will play to a modern child audience, but it's worth a try. And I think that it's a bit of fun, particularly if the kid's already read a bit of Dr. Seuss and has got a bit of a background in that.
Brenner, McQueen, Culver, Vaughn, Brunson, Buchholz, Dexter, the Magnificent Seven.
I wish you to help us.
There's this man, Calvera.
A thief.
A murderer.
He and his men, they steal our food. And then they leave us to starve.
and he will do so until he is stopped.
Even five won't give us too much trouble.
There won't be any trouble. Ride on.
Ride on? I'm going into the hills for the winter. Where am I going to get the food for my men?
Buy it or grow it.
Or maybe even work for it.
Somehow I don't think you solved my problem.
We deal in lead, friend.
Solving your problems isn't our line.
Yep, see, I said there were going to be some non-children's films I'm going to recommend, and Magnificent Seven has to be one of them. It's just a great adventure film. And looking at it from a modern viewpoint, there's not really anything in it that's not kid-safe. It's about seven guys who go out and help the Mexican village. You all know the story, but I think The Magnificent Seven would be a great movie to show a kid. I like the ensemble. Only one of whom's still alive. Robert Vaughn's the only actor in The Magnificent Seven who's still alive, by the way. There's a trivia answer for you. And I'm going to do what I once did in the podcast before, rattle off all of the names of the actors in The Magnificent Seven from memory. Yul Brynner, Steve McQueen, Horst Buchholz, Brad Dexter, Robert Vaughn, Charles Bronson, James Coburn. There you go. Magnificent Seven from memory. Yeah, I was kind of looking outside of the normal stuff, and the movie, these movies, these classic westerns and adventure films and things like that, don't have anything that by our standards isn't kid safe. Yeah, when people get shot, there's no blood and guts. They fall down, you might see a tiny patch of blood, that kind of thing. The violence is a lot less than the action is, which is the reverse of a lot of modern films. So I think catching a few classic adventure films and letting a kid watch them, particularly a boy child. I mean, I may be skewing this whole podcast towards the males, and I apologize if I am. There's a few reasons for that, one of which is that I'm a guy, and another is that a lot of movies that I think were aimed at female children, I find kind of unwatchable. So I am aware of that shortcoming on my behalf, but I'm going to kind of roll with things anyway and see where this goes. So The Magnificent Seven, definitely. And as you may have heard from earlier podcasts, I did my own alternative Magnificent Seven at some stage, which has just given me an idea. Maybe one of the things I can do in future podcasts is do a classic female Magnificent Seven ensemble, one each podcast. I might start next podcast. Let me know what you think of the idea of doing a female action hero from the classic cinema age, Magnificent Seven, alternatives to the male versions of the Magnificent Seven. It's just an idea I'm going to throw out there. Let me know what you think. But I'm digressing. The Magnificent Seven, definitely that, and maybe as a companion piece to that, if you want to throw a war film in there, something like The Great Escape, or one of those great blockbuster war films, particularly with Steve McQueen playing the breakout king in the Great Escape. Maybe that's another one to throw in there too. Just some of those really quality films that are accessible to children and have that great sense of adventure and those tremendous character actors in the roles. I think the actors will draw the kids in as much as the action will. And even though there's no transforming robots and you know, buildings being smashed to pieces by them the way there is in that silly Transformers franchise that's on at the moment, I think these kind of films would work. I mean, I can see kids playing The Magnificent Seven afterwards. I'll tell you a story about guns and children. A close friend of mine, she decided, she was a single mum, bringing up her kid, she would never let him play with guns. Didn't want the whole violence thing. Now, in Australia, that's less of a problem than it is in America. Guns aren't very accessible here, fortunately. And so there's a reduced risk of children accidentally playing with a real gun and blowing something off. She decided no guns. And we respected that. All the friends respected that. We didn't buy him machetes or M16 facsimile guns or anything like that. We kind of respected that. So one day, a bunch of us were at a picnic in a pine forest. in an old volcanic crater called Mount Franklin, not too far away from Melbourne. We're all there, you know, having the picnic, enjoying ourselves, and the kid's there. I won't mention him by name, I don't want to embarrass anybody. But he's there. Turns around, shot me with a pine cone. He had a pine cone he was using as a gun, which leads me to suspect that you really can't stop your kids playing shoot 'em ups. If there are no guns available, they are going to pick up a stick. They are going to pick up a pine cone. They are going to pick up a very long pencil and shoot somebody with it. So there's my story about that. So I'm aware of the impact of violence on children, but I think these movies, particularly from the kind of era we're talking about, don't really have anywhere near the visceral level of violence that many modern movies and even TV shows have these days. I think that it's not necessarily a desensitization. I think that from our viewpoint now, a lot of violence in the older films is abstract. Bang, someone falls down, and that's pretty much the extent of it. While there are two sides to that, it doesn't show a realistic picture of violence. I think when a child's a certain age, that having that abstraction and having that reduced reality is probably the way to go. Later on, when they're older, show them The Wild Bunch. Show them anything else where things like that happen. Show them Sniper with Mark Wahlberg, whatever you need to do. But I think that classic films are probably the way to go with adventure flicks for children. Magnificent Seven, The Great Escape are great examples of things. And there are any number of other ones. I mean, in the 1960s, there was that enormous wave of nostalgic films for World War II. The people who had lived through World War II were in their 40s and 50s and wanted to see some action films that made their admittedly heroic acts appear heroic on the screen. And there were things like, of course, The Great Escape. There was The Dirty Dozen. There were all those great classic films. The Battle of Britain, Bridget Remagen. Any one of those ones. And, of course, Quentin Tarantino is now using that as a resource for Inglourious Basterds, a film which I am looking forward very much. I like Tarantino's postmodern spin on these things, and I've seen a few trailers from Inglourious Basterds, and it's very much in that genre. And, of course, with the hyper-violence of a Quentin Tarantino film. But leaving that aside, maybe a few of those classic films is a good way to go to introduce kids to some other things. Now, I'm going to go into something a little bit different now, and let me know what you think about this one.
Monsieur, your nose is rather large.
Rather?
Oh, well.
Is that all?
Well, of course it is.
No, young sir, you're too simple. Why, you might have said a great many things. Why waste your opportunity? For example, thus. Aggressive. I, sir, if that nose were mine, I'd have it amputated on the spot. Practical. How do you drink with such a nose? You must have had a cup made especially. Descriptive. 'Tis a rock, a crag, a cape. A cape? Say rather a peninsula. Inquisitive. What is that receptacle? A razor case or a portfolio? Kindly. Ah, do you love the little birds so much that when they come and sing to you, you give them this to perch on? Cautious. Take care. A weight like that might make you top-heavy. Eloquent. When it blows, the typhoon howls and the clouds darken. Dramatic. When it bleeds, the Red Sea. Simple. When do they unveil the monument? Military. Beware, a secret weapon. Enterprising. What a sign for some perfumer. Respectful. Sir, I recognize in you a man of parts, a man of prominence. Or, literary, was this the nose that launched 1,000 ships? These, my dear sir, are things you might have said had you some tinge of letters or of wit to color your discourse. But wit, not so. You never had an atom. And of letters, you need but three to write you down. A-S-S. Ass.
It's puppy. Dolt. Bumpkin. Fool.
How do you do? And I, Cyrano, Savinien, Hercule de Bergerac.
Yep, it's the 1950 Cyrano de Bergerac starring José Ferrer, and it's a great movie. I'll tell you a personal story about this one. The only time in my entire school career, which admittedly wasn't all that long, it only went till I was 15, the only time that I ever skipped school, wagged school, whatever you call it, wherever you are, was one Monday because I wanted to go to my friend's place and for the midday movie, watch Cyrano de Bergerac with my mate, Stephen, who I haven't seen in a very long time. That is the only time I ever skipped school. Now, it was in December, beginning of December, so it was towards the end of the school year, and I kept promising to get a note from my father to cover the absence from school, but the school year ended a few days later, and I got away with it. It's the only time I ever skipped school, and I got away with it, and I got to see one of the great swashbuckling films of cinema. It doesn't get mentioned as much as a lot of other things like The Crimson Pirate and The Adventures of Robin Hood and Captain Blood and all of those other ones, but I like Cyrano de Bergerac. It's got that grand love story. It was made on a very small budget based, of course, on Edmund Rostand's play, which I now have a copy of, fortunately. It took me 20 years to find the play for some reason, but I now have a copy of it, and it's just a favourite movie of mine for a lot of reasons, including that story about skipping school. José Ferrer is fantastic as Cyrano, and he won an Academy Award for the role as well, which is surprising on so small a film at that stage. It wasn't a studio film at all, and Ferrer got the Oscar for Best Actor. If you haven't seen it, the movie is in public domain and has been for a number of years, so you probably find it on archive.org or one of those other sites that has public domain films. The prints aren't always the best, but it's one of those films that's worth having, and you should be able to pick it up even on DVD fairly cheaply as a public domain release. And it should be in your collection. It's just a lot of fun. Marla Powers plays Roxanne in it. I like it, and I liked it as a kid, which is one of the reasons I'm including this one in there. The dialogue is eloquent but accessible. It's one of those pleasure movies that I have. Haven't watched it in a few years. I should re-watch it. But if you just wanted to have a tasting, there are clips from it on YouTube. I believe the whole movie may be on YouTube, in fact, in various parts. There might be something like 8 parts to it to watch. But if you haven't seen that version of Cyrano, definitely do so. Of course, there's a good Gerard Depardieu one from the 1990s as well. But I still have an enormous fondness for the 1950 José Ferrer one. So that's my next recommendation, Cyrano de Bergerac.
Imagine yourself as one of the crew of this faster-than-light spaceship of the future, sharing their curiosity to know the unknown, their tension, their readiness for inconceivable adventures.
Sir, we're being radar scanned.
United Planets cruiser C-57D, J.J. Adams commanding. Who are you?
Morbius of the Bellerophon.
Well, Dr. Morbius, my orders are to survey the situation on Altair 4.
Commander, if you sat down on this planet, I warn you that I cannot be answerable for the safety of your ship or your crew.
When you reach the Forbidden Planet, you will meet Dr. Morbius, played by Walter Pidgeon. The doctor is sole owner of this fabulous world. Anne Francis is his alluring daughter, Alta, who has never seen a young man till she meets Commander Adams, played by talented Leslie Nielsen.
Not in.
Didn't bring my bathing suit.
What's a bathing suit?
Oh, murder.
You will meet a charming character in The Robot, able to produce on order 10 tons of lead or a slinky evening gown. Always at your service.
It must be the loveliest, softest thing you've ever made for me. And fit in all the right places, with lots and lots of star sapphires.
Star sapphires take a week to crystallize properly. Would diamond or emeralds do?
Gotta have Forbidden Planet in there. It's the kind of science fiction adventure film. It's the inspiration for Star Trek. It's shitloads better than any Star Wars movie ever made. It's based on Shakespeare's The Tempest and was a big studio movie at the time, and just is full of that science fictional sense of wonder. A whole planet that's basically a machine for creating nightmares. It's got Robbie the Robot. It has the crew of the starship who pretty much act like World War II sailors. It's got Earl Holliman playing the cook on the spaceship, and Leslie Nielsen and Warren Stevens, and Walter Pigeon as Morbius, who doesn't really understand his own nature. And it's got the great landscapes of Altair 4. The special effects still hold up pretty well. They're not really on the scale of modern special effects that tend to draw attention to themselves to a great extent, but definitely this is the go-to genesis of quality science fiction space opera, and anybody should be introducing their kids to Forbidden Planet. It's one of those great films, and I can rewatch it twice a year, I suppose, and still enjoy it and still get a little bit more out of it each time. And it's got those wonderful tonality soundtrack score by the Lewis and B.B. Baron, which is still incredibly futuristic sounding and just a really out there kind of thing to do in the middle 1950s for a science fiction film. I think it was done with great artistry and great care, and is probably the best big studio science fiction film of the 1950s and one of the best science fiction films of all time. I don't really know anybody that doesn't like it. You'd be remiss if you didn't show a kid Forbidden Planet, even though the monster from the it is pretty scary and was considered so scary in Australia that some bits of the monster, even though it was invisible, were cut out by the Australian censors in the 1950s, way up until the 1980s almost. So I didn't see an uncut print of Forbidden Planet until I was an adult. So one of my great recommendations, Forbidden Planet. I had to throw a Bruce Lee movie in here. I think Bruce Lee has tended to be marginalised by more recent martial arts stuff, the wire work and special effects kind of things. People like Jackie Chan and later Jet Li have cast Bruce Lee further back into the past, even though he was the first international, and in the Western world at least, martial arts hero who was Asian. I think you've got to throw a Bruce Lee movie in there because basically it's real. Anything you see Bruce Lee do in a movie, Bruce Lee is actually doing. And the most accessible one with no subtitles to really speak of is his second last film up before Game of Death, Enter the Dragon. Now, you can diss Enter the Dragon if you like, but in 2004 it was deemed culturally significant and was selected for preservation in the American National Film Registry. So it's highly regarded these days. It was directed by Rob Klaus, starring Bruce Lee, Jim Kelly, and John Saxon. It was the last completed film Bruce Lee did before his death. The Game of Death, they actually used some body doubles to complete the work. But the movie's not really groundbreaking apart from Bruce Lee's involvement in it. It's kind of like a James Bond film, yeah. bad guy lives on an island and is doing nasty things with drugs and slavery and prostitution, and basically a team of three guys is sent to the island for a martial arts tournament in order to gather evidence and basically bust up the bad guy's crime ring, the mysterious guy called Han, played by Shig Kid. And I loved this film when I first saw it. I got into martial arts films before a lot of other people did in Australia. I did martial arts very briefly in my late teens, and a friend of mine used to pop around to Chinatown cinemas and watch The Big Boss and The Chinese Connection and Way of the Dragon, all of those Bruce Lee movies, just before they became really big and went totally viral, and everybody wanted to see a Bruce Lee movie and everybody was impressed by him, and the Green Hornet TV series came back on TV because Bruce Lee was in it and all those sorts of things. Bruce Lee was a unique character in film. I don't particularly believe he was a fantastic actor, but he was a great character. He had that enormous presence. He had that immense physicality. And his martial arts ability haven't been equaled in cinema. He really was the best of the best at that sort of thing. And, of course, as everyone knows, he died at an early age of some kind of brain hemorrhage. The reasons for his death, there are lots of legends around it, as well as there are with anybody who dies at the peak of their cinema career. There are always stories and legends and conspiracy theories and any number of other explanations for something that people just don't find acceptable for a simple reason. The director of this film, Robert Klaus, was a standard, not particularly great or well-regarded action director. He had done a movie that I kind of liked, but is very hard to find a decent print of these days, Darker Than Amber, the movie based on the John D. McDonald Travis McGee novel starring Rod Taylor. He directed that one, so he was an action director more than anything, and his career wasn't enormous. He did another film, a kung fu movie after this called Golden Needles, which I haven't seen in a very long time. But Robert Klaus directs the action scenes very well, and unlike modern action scenes where there's a bit too much shaky cam and quick editing, in a movie like Enter the Dragon, it's very accessible from the fact that there are lots of wide shots. The martial arts action is a lot easier to follow than a lot of the fight action in modern films. For that reason, there's not just that kind of quick flurry of impressions and then somebody falls on the floor with their head cracked open. Maybe it's an introduction for somebody introducing their kid to movies, into martial arts cinema. I suppose you can look at the violence aspect, and of course that's something every parent needs to look at for themselves, but I think that Bruce Lee, I think that particularly a film like Enter the Dragon with Bruce Lee in it is an accessible film for kids. Lots of teenagers saw it when I was in my teens, and it was just it just went totally viral. It was the biggest thing on the planet at the time as far as cinema is concerned. And that wonderful soundtrack by Lalo Schifrin is very much a part of it. It's got a weird combination of kind of Asian influences and blaxploitation, waka-chika, waka-chika kind of beat in the background. So it's one of his best soundtracks of the 1970s, in fact, and I've had a copy of it ever since I used to get music on cassette tapes. So I used to have a cassette tape of the soundtrack of Enter the Dragon. You had to flip the tape over halfway through the soundtrack, that kind of thing. As I said, I think there are a few subtitles in it, but not very many. And it's just as a pure action film and as a proper martial arts film rather than a bullshit one, Enter the Dragon is definitely the way to go. And of course, Jim Kelly, one of the other characters in the movie, was a martial artist. And John Saxon, even though he was an actor since his teenage years in the 1950s, had done martial arts as well. So there's a certain credibility to the action there. And the Hong Kong locations are fantastic too. The climactic battle has a nod to Orson Welles' Lady in Shanghai, where Han and Lee fight it out in a hall of mirrors in a way that is a bit of a homage to the Lady of Shanghai, but has its own strength because it's not a gunfight in a hall of mirrors. It's actually a martial arts fight, and Robert Klaus as a director builds up the tension pretty well in that scene, as in a lot of others. So that's my next recommendation. It's a bit off the, out there, but Enter the Dragon, definitely a film to see again. I'm going to have to rewatch it myself now. Now I'm going to talk about one more film before this, the podcast ends. Well, not necessarily one film, but the career of one actor and a few films that I think would be wonderful for children to view. Okay, I have plans to talk a lot more about the films of this particular filmmaker in a future podcast. I think it's well worth doing a podcast entirely about the movies of Jacques Tati. If you haven't seen them, you are so lucky because you get to see them for the first time. He didn't make many films. I think he made about 7 of them in his entire film career. But every one of them is a wonderful, warm, human, humane film. The first full-length film that Tati made was Jour de Fête, which is about a village postman in France who sees how efficient, he sees a documentary about how efficient the American Postal Service is and decides that on his little bicycle he's going to try to make his postal service really efficient. It's full of beautiful sight gags and bits of business and wonderful physical comedy. So the language barrier doesn't, in a Jacques Tati film, isn't a really a barrier for children. A lot of it's done in mime and in non-verbal ways, apart from the use of some pretty wonderful music. The music in Jacques Tati movies is always fantastic, and it's always perfect for the film, and some sound effects at various times. So Jour de Fête was his first film in the late 1947, he filmed it. The interesting thing about this film is he filmed it in a village where he found refuge from Nazi recruiters during the German occupation of France. He promised that he would come back after the war and make a film in this particular village. I'm just trying to find the name of it here, but I don't seem to have it on this list that I've got. So he came back and he made Jour de Fête in a village, and a lot of the characters in the film are actually the villagers who helped hide Jacques Tati, who was a cabaret artist at the time. He did a lot of stage work before the war and did some small short films before World War II. He was a rugby player, amongst other things, before that. But I really like the fact that his personal history merges in with the films in this one. The second film he made is probably the one I'd recommend first for a child to watch, which is Monsieur Hulot's Holiday. How do you describe it if you haven't seen it? Rowan Atkinson's Mr. Bean basically pinches a lot of Monsieur Hulot's stuff, but I think Mr. Bean's a less lovable character than Monsieur Hulot in a lot of ways. A lot of the physical business and the physical comedy is there, but I think the unwavering politeness of the gormless Monsieur Hulot really shits on Mr. Bean, to be honest. Basically, it's about Monsieur Hulot taking a holiday and it at a small beach resort in August, and it takes the piss out of, you know, various tight-ass aspects of French political and social classes. There are some English tourists there as well, but the physical comedy is marvellous and is incredibly imaginative as well. Now, the only really nice characters in Monsieur Hulot's Holiday, which is another reason why I'd recommend this film, are Hulot himself and the children. The children instinctively understand him as a person, as a character. And I think that works really well and makes it very accessible. The other films he made were pretty marvelous. Mon Oncle, 1958 film, which is probably another one I'd recommend. It centers around Monsieur Hulot and his sister's husband lives in one part of town where they've got every modern convenience and gadgets and a very sterile household environment, whereas Hulot and his pet dog live in the old part of town, which is wonderful and is rich and full of classic French culture. And they play off the dichotomy of the cold, sterile modern life against the old style village life in France. And there are some incredible bits of business in it, like a game the children play to get people to bump their heads against a lamppost, and the way the little dog, the dog's actually his sister's dog, I think, sneaks out of town and goes and plays with the other dogs around town and then slips back into the house as well when he thinks he's going to be discovered. So just a great film. There's Playtime, which was incredibly, it was a kind of breaking point for Tati. He made an entire set called Tativille. He basically made a set that was an entire city block, a couple of city blocks, and filmed Playtime, which was set in the city, in a kind of futuristic glass and steel Paris where there are only tiny little bits of old culture resurrecting, and of course Hulot being in there. And it ends on a fabulous emulation of a merry-go-round. I won't spoil it too much, but these films just warm your heart. I haven't yet seen Traffic. Somebody did give me a copy of Traffic very recently, and thank you very much for that. But Jacques Tati movies, I like them so much that I really don't want to watch them too often so that the magic wears off or I get used to the magic of these films. I'm holding off on watching Traffic because I'm going to want to kind of savour it. It's like having something very nice in your fridge. You don't quite want to eat it yet because you know you're going to enjoy it so much when you do. And I feel the same way about seeing Traffic, which I have never seen. And I will, of course. But I do want to talk a lot more about Jacques Tati movies in a future podcast. But I would recommend them because even though they're subtitled and they're in French, and children, of course, do have some trouble with subtitles, I think the subtitles in a Tati movie aren't necessary for the enjoyment of the film. Just the little bits of comedy and little bits of business and the kindness and humanity of these films is something that you'd want to expose a child to. That's my last and probably my best recommendation, the films of Jacques Tati. I think they're fantastic. Now, I used a few resources to do this podcast, one of which is the BFI list of must-see films for children. I have pinched some from there, to be honest with you, but I've added a few of my own. But that's a good resource. If you type in Google or something like BFI must-see films for children, you'll get an incredibly long list of modern and old films that the British Film Institute's laid out for as a resource for people to use. But let me know what films from the Paleo Cinema era you think children should watch too, apart from the obvious ones. I mean, as I've mentioned before, The Wizard of Oz and The Adventures of Robin Hood and all of those classics, and some other films I've spoken of on the previous podcast. The George Pal Time Machine, for instance, fantastic film. I love the humanity of that film, as well as the stop motion animation and the way that they used special effects within the limits of the technology of the time to evoke the world of the Morlocks and the Eloi and the passage through time. There are any number of good science fiction movies. Anything Ray Harryhausen did is a good film to watch, to get kids to watch. Valley of Gwangi, which I mentioned in a previous podcast, any of those sort of things. So that's about it for this time around. Next time around, I was thinking of doing a little bit of Samuel Fuller and the career of Samuel Fuller. I've got a couple of Fuller films I want to talk about. So I might well do that. As Sal said at the start of the show, the email address is cultguru@gmail.com, cultguru@gmail.com. The website is paleo-cinema.blogspot.com. And I will be talking at you again in 3 weeks. Enjoy your movie going until then. Drop me a line. Let me know what you think of this one. Goodbye.